Before we get into today's episode, I have a special announcement. From 17 to 20 October 2024, we will be holding a groundbreaking conference in Adelaide, Australia. The first Australasian Pacific Conference on Para-Reurbanisation and Serenology. Para-Reurbanisation and Serenology are important research fields of conscienciology, each in their own way concerned with the significant changes our planet is and will continue to experience for the foreseeable future. If you are not sure what these topics are about and would like to know more, you could listen to a couple of episodes of this podcast. Episode 51 with Tony Muskopf discusses serenology, or the study of the Homo sapiens serenissimus, our evolutionary future. In episode 18 with Alexandra Baltazar, I discuss para-reurbanization, the changes we consider to have started in the non-physical dimensions that are leading to profound changes in our physical reality and that are behind many of the social challenges of our era. If you feel drawn to these topics, then this conference is for you. In keeping with the principle of self-experimentation, there will be 2 days of presentations and discussions, as well as 2 days of thematically relevant parapsychic dynamics. A link to the conference website will be in the show notes. There you will find more information, including the call for papers, in case you want to present at the conference. We look forward to seeing you in beautiful Adelaide for this significant event. And now let's get on with today's episode. I invited today's guest, Alexandra Zaslavsky, because he regularly publishes and speaks about the question of science in the kind of self-applied consciousness research that conscienciology promotes, or for that matter, that any other discipline promotes that purports to explore states of consciousness or bioenergy in a scientific way. Yoga, for example, has called itself a science of consciousness ever since it was introduced to the Western world in the late 19th century. So the question is, how do we apply scientific principles to what are ostensibly subjective, intra-psychic experiences? Over the years, I have noticed in myself a definite resistance every time I hear people refer to conscienciology or yoga as science. Is it appropriate to call something science that is not based in any objective evidence, and that does not even attempt to establish such evidence? Sure, if you have an out-of-body experience, you can have evidence for yourself, but this is not something you can demonstrate to anybody else. Does science not demand us to provide objective evidence? I think this is a common understanding we have of science, and although I know that science is not necessarily about evidence, but about models, hypotheses, and refutation, I am also influenced by this popular image of it. So I really appreciated the opportunity to explore these issues with Alexandra. Topics we talk about include the role of experiments in our own personal evolution and what distinguishes experiments from experiences, the role of consciential laboratories, and what it means to make our life a laboratory, and ultimately, of course, whether it is appropriate to call conscienciology a science. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So my guest today is Alexandra Zaslavsky. Alexandra has a PhD in education. He teaches philosophy at a high school in Paraná, Brazil, and he has more than 20 years' experience in conscienciology. Alexandra is the chief editor of the conscienciological journal Interparadigmas, the joint coordinator of the Interscientific Council of the International Union of Conscio-Centric Institutions, and co-author of the book Existential Inversion that was published in 2011. And Alexandra, it is lovely to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I like to start, we always start the podcast with the principle of disbelief. Don't believe in anything. Have your own experiences, experiment, and come to your own conclusions. And I think this disbelief principle is something we'll definitely get back to later as we talk about the question of science and whether conscienciology
can be described as a science of consciousness. But before we go there, Alexandre, I always like to start with some insight as to how people and how you found your way to this subject area, to conscienceology, to the exploration of consciousness. So to give a bit of a background of your own life trajectory.
Okay. So, well, I think what brought me to conscienceology perhaps was the same that brought me to philosophy, I guess, when I was a teenager. I was very inquisitive, very curious. I liked to read and I was interested in the main, you know, questions of life, but also kind of mistrusting, you know, the usual answers. And when I started studying philosophy in the university, at the same time I started to look for whatever alternative streams of knowledge or, you know, approaches I could find there where I lived in Brazil. And went to, you know, Eastern institutions
like yoga and, or Hindu, that kind of thing.
Yes, like Hindu, Buddhism, everything that came up there. I went to check what it was like and what did I feel going there. Also, Spiritism, you know, in Brazil is very strong. So not spiritism, the Allan Kardec, you know, approach. And then I found a public lecture of projectology at the time. You know, many years ago, I was 19 years old. And then I identified with that. You know, the teacher was talking about science and scientific paradigms, and he was himself a physics teacher. So that, for me, it was, I think I immediately identified with it.
But had you had experiences at that point? Like, had you had out-of-body experiences you were trying to understand, or was it more of the ideas that excited you?
It was more the ideas at that point. And in fact, I was mostly, I guess, afraid of having those experiences. And I already admitted that can happen. But I was afraid at first. But then when I did the first courses there in Projectology Institute, half a year or a few months later, I started having out-of-body experiences, and then not so much, but some. And then I realized it was didn't have to be afraid or anything. It was mostly a pleasant experience.
Do you still remember your first experience or experiences, what the impact was of that?
Sure. Sure, but it is interesting because already in my first class, the very first class, I could feel the energies, you know, the vibrational state, not really perhaps the vibrational state, but the circulation of energies, and I think because of my frontal chakra, it's usually, I guess it's easier for me to sense it, you know, to perceive it. And at that point, it felt very strong, like this pressure, very strong.
And just for people who don't know, the frontal chakra is the chakra between your eyes, right at your forehead, what some people call the third eye.
Exactly. Exactly. But I had felt that before, but I didn't know what it was. It was not painful. It was kind of strange sensation. But when I at the Projectology Institute, I could understand. Well, that's a chakra. No, that's because it's active. So I had at the first class these energetic perceptions, and that connected with what I had already read. You know, about chakras and about altered states of consciousness and so on. But the first lucid projection of consciousness, it was a spontaneous one. It was during the night. And I gained consciousness, you know, I woke up inside the projection. I was in a restaurant and my brother entered the room, you know, came in the room, and he was with me in studying projectionology. He's still a volunteer of consensuality, but and he had experiences before me. So when I don't know why, but when I saw him, I realized, wait, well, this is a projection. I went to sleep some time ago, and this is a projection. So I tried to tell him, wow, we are projected, you know. And it seems he knew, but when I woke up, I checked with him, and he didn't remember. But we went to a visit in a friend of ours, to a house of a friend of ours, and we did a few things. And one of the things I remembered and tried to do was to volitate, you know?
To fly.
And yeah, it was difficult at first, but then I managed to do it once. So it was kind of a complete experience like this. It had many, you know, aspects of a projection I could experience there.
Yeah.
So,
I was going to say, it was your first kind of experiment, by the sounds of it. You had all these things you could tick off and say, okay, this was part of the projection. And
yes, exactly. It was, I was doing not... I was not aware of it, but I was doing experiments inside the projection. I had questions and I tried to test them, you know, to answer them. The flying, the volitation was one thing. But for example, the friend we met, he was kind of transparent, you know, translucent, his appearance. So that was also something interesting. I could not hear him well, and I don't know what was that, if his energies were more subtle than ours, maybe. Or it was, we're not exactly in the same dimension, I don't know.
Yeah, it does seem that there can be these subtle shifts between dimensions, right? I guess just as we in the physical can have extra physical consciousnesses that are denser and that are more subtle, and the same continues right on in the extra physical dimension.
Right. Yeah.
And so then you had your out of body experience. I guess that might have been quite confirming for you, quite made you feel that you're on the right path with this line of study.
Yes, it did. It was unbelievable. I think well, it's not a matter of believing, but I always, sometimes I, when I have those kind of experiences, spontaneous, I was not expecting that. I wake up and then I realize, wait, I just had that, you know, that just happened. So it's different than I expect. It's more, I think, normal than I expect. It's what its impact is not like emotional or thrilling or something. It's calmer, you know. It's more I wake up and then I realize I had a lucid projection, or I had like this retrocognitive projection or something that was retrocognitive, I think. So
in what way was it retrocognitive?
No, that was, I think that one was a bit retrocognitive in regard to my intermissive course, I think.
Oh, okay.
Because when I thought about flying, you know, can I say volitate?
Flying is technically, yes, but flying is definitely more common.
All right. So when I thought about it, I saw myself in this, how do you say, a empty spot inside a forest, you know, like this circle.
A clearing. A clearing.
Clearing, right. Clearing. I was in a clearing. Yeah, clareira in Portuguese, mm-hmm. clearing. I was in a clearing. And there was this sort of flying workshop.
Right.
And people were trying to learn how to do that. And there were instructors, you know, oh, focus, you know, focus your wheel. Make, you know, try to do that. And there were the students were there, and I think with each one of them, there was a coach, some sort of coach, of flying coach or something. And I also tried to do it. And at first I couldn't, you know,
take off.
How can I say that?
Take off.
Take off. Yeah, I was taking off a little and then returning. And then I concentrated more. And then I suddenly took off.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really in control. So I was like turning around myself and spinning around, you know.
Right.
And then I got down. And I had other experiences after that, years now, after that.
Can I just check something? What you just described, was this a projection or was this a memory of your intermissive course that you had in a projection?
No, the projection.
It was a projection.
Well, itself. I don't know. At this point, I would say the projection. But
yes.
Since I had other experiences that, and there were clearances also, and it seems that other people remember as well, like clearances.
Clearings, you mean in the forest?
Yes, yes. Yeah. In the having experiences during their intermissive courses in clearances. So that make me raise this hypothesis, you know, that could be related to the intermissive course, I think.
And I guess my understanding is that sometimes in intermissive courses, we also have projectors come and visit, right? And maybe I should just explain, if anybody listening doesn't know, that the idea of intermissive courses is courses we do in between lifetimes. So it's a preparation we've done in the extra physical period for this current lifetime, for example. But is that your understanding, that sometimes we might be projected and visit an intermissive course as well?
Yes, we can. I think so. Sometimes, yeah, could be that. Could be that mixed with my memories.
Yeah.
But I think that part of the projection was, you know, it had that theme of the intermissive course.
Yeah.
So it was the only time I had exactly that, you know, that training. The other times I could do it, better.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then you had these quite profound experiences, profound, but also you said quite calm, right? These out of body experiences. It's not like you woke up and felt that your world had changed in a way, or did you notice some, I don't know, did it take a while to integrate these experiences in your life, or did you just sort of take it in your stride?
I guess I'm still integrating them, I guess. I think because for me it's always intellectually first, and so I understood already what that meant, you know, that phenomena meant, what were consequences for a paradigm shift, for example. You know, if that's real, then we need to shift our paradigms. You know, there must be other ways of conceiving reality. but the experiences, they are much more meaningful than that. I think we are sometimes many years after having one experience, I realize it had a different meaning or it meant more than I thought at first. So that's, I think that's related to the principle of disbelief. That's one of the motives or reasons of the principle of disbelief, because experience in the way we understand it in conscienciology, or in the way conscienciology understands it, it's so dense of, you know, it has so much implications, consequences. That's very...
Yeah, it that is true. And at the same time, so for a long time, when I first discovered conscienciology, that principle of disbelief really spoke to me as well, right? This emphasis on don't believe in anything, experiment, have your own experiences. And I, over the years, I guess one of the things that has started to raise some doubts for me, maybe not exactly doubts, but like it's questioned the, it's made me realize that we need to be perhaps more elaborate about what we mean, is noticing people who have certain experiences, and that gives rise to a worldview that to me is surprising, it's inaccurate. And maybe one of the most extreme examples that I can think of is that when Trump first became elected, there was a series, quite a remarkable series, and I saw people post about it on Facebook, and I read articles about it, of people who had dreams and out-of-body experiences in which he appeared as some kind of savior figure. And I saw people writing very elaborate stories about how he was kind of like a second coming of some figure, right? And
I'm sorry, what kind of figure? What was that word?
A savior figure.
Savior,
Salvador. Yeah. It just highlighted for me the incompleteness, the potential risk, right, of having a certain experience that we then think we treat whatever that was as the truth. There are many stories of people, for example, that have, we don't have to go to the extreme of someone like Trump, but many people in the near-death experiences who have encounters with a Jesus-like figure, and then based on that, convert to Christianity and experience that as their truth, right? And I guess that highlights for me the risk that experience itself is also not enough. And I'd be curious on your thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess when I find this density or richness of information and experiences, I suppose I have already a background, intellectual background or theoretical. And for me, conscienciology was always a science. Since my first contact, I could see some scientific traits in it, because I was already studying, for example, philosophy of science, so on. That make a big difference for me. But yes, I think experience only, if there's not, because we need a sort of framework in order to analyze and kind of absorb what experience brings. So if this background is, for example, religious or maybe unconsciously so, it probably will be used to judge what's that is going on. So if a figure appears showing himself as Jesus Christ, for me, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if I eventually, you know, meet with someone doing that, I will immediately, like, well, first of all, that doesn't mean nothing special to me, but I will, I think I will, how can I say?
Question?
I will
question it? Or?
Question that, right? So, but there comes my, what I've been working on Conscienciology, the trying to elaborate, to develop a methodological approach or a method, a scientific method that could be described. So try to, you know, describe what could be such a method, because that, if it's a science, that the method is there, but perhaps implicit, not yet developed or fully developed. And I think, well, my guess, you know, the answer goes that way, trying to understand and to develop what's the new epistemological approach of Conscienciology, you know, what does it have to offer in a, as a new way of, a new knowledge, or how do we get, how do we obtain this knowledge? Like that.
Yeah. And so what comes up for me when I hear you talking is that even though on the one hand we value experience as a foundation for our own personal understanding, the experience has to exist within a framework. And it sort of informs that the two inform each other, right? The framework informs our experience and our interpretation of it, and our experiences at the same time. I guess if our experiences start challenging the framework, we have to be open to that as well, right? That we go, actually, right, this framework doesn't capture anymore my experience.
Yeah, I understand, even in how we call, like, this mainstream science or, you know, academic science, that is, many people already accept that, you know, that experience and a theoretical framework, they, how do you say, they're like a circle, you know?
Like a feedback loop. What? Like a feedback loop.
Yeah, or they make a feedback loop and so on. You can't, this is, old belief, ancient belief, that experience alone is enough. But at the same time, yeah, it's a feedback, because we need to be open and let experience challenge the theoretical framework. Mm. But the method is a way to do it responsibly, like seriously, not in a way that could be described. So what was that experience like, and why and how does it challenge the framework? So that's the difference of science. You know, that's because science needs to, I mean, generally, you know, yeah, science needs to show that, you know, how, why do you think, you know, we should change our assumptions and theories and so on.
Yeah,
and Conscienciology, we have this new kind of data, if you want. It's a, because it's a first-person data, and it exists in, for example, humanities. Some social sciences do that, you know, collect data personally.
Yeah,
but the techniques we have in Conscienciology allow us to collect this data from a different source as well. For example, about bioenergies, for example, this, like we said a moment ago, about the chakras. So I can feel my frontal chakra, And there's this exchange of energies between us and so on. Yeah, it could turn to be data to a research that. And I think this is new because in conscienciology, it doesn't have a mystical, you know, background. We can talk about that quite normally. And for us, I mean, the researchers in conscienciology, it's a natural thing, I'd say. Like, it's not, and when I talk about this kind of things with other people, you know, they don't know conscienciology, but they are also interested in that, you know, energies and chakras. Many people, they consider it this in the, like, religiously, in a way. You know, they feel a lot of emotions, and there's nothing wrong about it, but at the same time, I mean, it's a different approach to the phenomena and the data. That's what I think, and that's what I try to, you know, describe. You know, what's that first person approach we're trying to do?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a couple of points, I guess, I'd like to pick up on that. One is the religious one, which we'll get to maybe in a minute. But when we talk about, in conscienciology, we use data that isn't used, say, in conventional science. But it is precisely that data that actually would cause a lot of people to say, well, conscienciology isn't a science. Because we are using data that conventional science doesn't actually accept is data, in the sense that you and I could be sitting here talking about the pulsations we're feeling in our fronto chakras, and that is not a recognized fact in the universe of conventional science. There is a study of consciousness that explores out-of-body experiences in conventional universities and so on. But as far as I'm aware, last time I checked the literature, there is definitely no consensus that they represent a consciousness leaving the physical body. There are many different theories and ideas and so on. And I guess what I was thinking about when I think about conscienciology, it's like, in a sense, it's creating a science for the converted, if you want, or for those people who have had certain experiences and who can relate to the phenomena. So it's almost like a parallel. To me, it seems like what we're doing is a parallel science, if you want, that has the fundamental principles are still keeping us separate from conventional science. What do you think about?
I'll begin with the end, but I agree. It is a parallel approach, no doubt, because as you said, the assumptions of conscienciology, they are not accepted by conventional science, and they cannot be accepted yet by conventional science. And about the data, at this point, some of that data, I think they would be accepted by some groups of conventional science, but as evidence, not necessarily as realities. For example, in the health sciences, psychology, and so on, now some groups, more progressive groups, they consider altered states of consciousness as legitimate experiences. They don't judge if those are real. That's another problem, like a philosophical problem. But for their concern as physicians or psychologists, so on, they they consider them as experiences of their subjects. So I think that's a difference. That's new. I think it shows some openness. So they don't consider it absurd anymore. It's not absurd.
That is true.
And and there's this big, how can I say, approach in health sciences. I guess it's making some influence, like spirituality and so on. Like they are using mindful techniques, and that comes from yoga. And so that sort of discipline or spiritual disciplines, and they are being used, but at the same time, they are separated from the religious or mystical beliefs. So they are testing it in hospitals, for example, with people that are recovering from diseases or surgeries. Well, try to do this kind of practice and see if you feel better. So I think there are some spots opening, you know, in conventional science to that kind of data. But if the reality of the projection of consciousness, that will take time, I think, because that is intransferable. Can I say that? That's always a first person. If we approach it from the third person, like that guy there had a projection of consciousness, doesn't solve the problem. You know, it's solved for him. But so that concept of for a first person science, that's the problem. And also, but also it's a different notion of reality, the extraphysical reality. It's not, if you consider science assumes there's a reality, a common reality, it's a material reality, and that can be approached similarly by different people. So if you do an experiment, the other scientists can replicate it, you know, can make the same thing. So it's one of the main features of science, replicability. Because there's a common reality, an immaterial reality. But the multidimensional reality, it's not like that. You know, so I think the idea of the having your own experiences, there's no way to, you know, there's no other way, I think, at this point. The scientists or intellectuals or whatever, they will at some moment begin to value their own experiences. And then it will begin to, you know, to do that. What's that? The feedback, the circle feedback.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And, you know, I actually met some of these people, the like scientists, which have out of body experiences, some have precognitive experiences, and some are trying to, you know, conceptualize it, you know, are trying to, many people, they keep it parallel. Many people in the academic, you know, institutions, they have, of course they have experiences like that, but they don't mix things, you know, they keep them separate. Now, my profession is science, and my personal life, I have that, but one thing is different from the other. But some are trying to
bridge the gap to make
land connections. To bridge them. And in the journal, we have published a few examples. We have one article per edition. I think it's from a researcher which is not in conscientiology, but is trying to make that bridge, you know. And it's interesting to see that.
Yes.
So I guess in summary, it all takes personal experiences, you know, probably conventional science will accept some things, but the reality of it will take time because it's not possible to prove it objectively.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's talk about I've seen you talk elsewhere about the distinction between experiences and experiments. And I think that's a really important point, right? What does it look like to, because for me, I feel that's also the step that takes us beyond perhaps the initial, like over-interpreting one experience and creating a fixed worldview based on that is this idea of experiments. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I've been working on it. It's been a few years. And I think what we could call the self-experimental method, it's my best, you know, guess of a formal method, a conscienciological scientific method, a self-experimental one. So experience means a mandatory thing. You know, everyone has experiences all the time. So experience is like, it's indefinite. It's a stream of information we have all the time. So that's not a method. Experience itself, it's only a stream of information.
Yeah.
Okay. But an experiment is a act of testing experience. So I intervene in experience. I do something and I watch or monitor what happens then. So that's conventional experimentation, like laboratory experimentation. Something which happens in nature, the scientists go there and try to make it in the lab and, you know, test variables. So self-experimentation within conscienciology, it's kind of the same, but done with your own consciousness, because the basis of experimentalism is physical energy. So that's the basis, you know, when any experimentation assumes the laws of physical energy. But in conscienciology, we have consciential energy, and we manifest through consciential energy. We are always talking here in first person.
Yeah.
Always.
Maybe you could just clarify the distinction if anybody doesn't know what exactly you mean by consciential energy. What do you mean by the difference between physical energy and consciential energy?
Well, physical energy is that kind of, well, it's measurable with instruments, for example, electric energy or mechanical energy. The energy we use in our world, you know, daily. And consciential energy is a subtle energy. It's not physical. And it can't be measured yet by instruments. We don't know how to turn it into physical energy. Some people believe it's possible, but we can't do it just yet. But we can feel it in ourselves. It's subtle because it's not like it's subtler than material energy or physical energy. And it is the strength each one of us have to do things, like to think, to feel, and to manifest. You know, the when we so the consciential energy is the this energy which consciousness uses to manifest himself or herself. But we don't have a definition exact what's the nature of consciential energy. I can't answer that. But I guess they can't answer what's the nature of physical energy.
Yeah, the nature of things is often we can measure the manifestation, right? But not the what it actually is. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So self-experimentation is based on consciential energy. So I can, we use consciential energy to manifest ourselves, and we don't necessarily realize it or perceive it. We just do it. It's natural. It's physiological. Mm. But if we get more aware of consciential energy in daily life, we can divide our attention and at the same time do what we are doing, but observe what is happening energetically. For example, feeling good or feeling bad. Like it's everyone has it. You know, wow, in some places I don't feel so good. Or when I meet that person, I feel really good. That person, I don't know why. But if we watch the energies, they show in more detail what is happening. So we can test it. For example, what happens if I exteriorize energy just in that moment? What happens, for example, if I exteriorize the energy with my cardio chakra right there? You know, will that increase? Or what's if I'm not feeling so good, will I feel better? Or the vibrational state is a great basic technique in conscientiology, and it also a self-experimental tool. So I can test it, like install a vibrational state and see what happens. So that combined operation, like one, install the vibrational state, and two, observe what happens. That is already a method, because it's not an isolated technique. The technique itself is not a method. That's another distinction, The right. Technique itself, it aims some purpose, like to make something. That's a technique, make something well. But the method, it combines technique in order to achieve something more complex. So a scientific method, it's a combination of techniques in order to obtain knowledge. So if I apply or install a energetic technique, but at the same time I monitor some variables, that's a method, That's like I'm trying to give you a simple notion. Yes. What would be like the self-experimental method, self-experimentation.
And my sense is a key part of it would be to track the results, right? To make notes, to go, okay, these were the circumstances. This is what I applied. This is the technique I applied. And this is the effects that I had. And the effects in this case would be changes to my emotions, changes to my thoughts, changes to my physical well-being or anything like that, anything that's kind of intra-psychic that we can notice, right?
Yeah. The amount of, so when one does it, it's they're collecting data. What's happening when I do that? That's data. So yeah. Person collects data, and the amount of that data can lead to some conclusions. Like, not of course, temporary conclusions, but it's knowledge. I think we can say it's scientific knowledge because it has method. I think that kind of summarizes it. But the object, I think it's the main problem with conventional science. It's the object that's not accepted. But the method, I think if we describe how we are doing it, I think we can say it is a method.
Yeah.
Your question was the difference between experience and experiment in conscientiology.
Yes.
So experience is what happens to us. It's the experience, it's an effect. It's the reaction our physiology or paraphysiology has all day long, all the time. But experiment is what one does in order to test experience. So it's an active posture, you know, active attitude towards experience. So instead of just receiving experience or going through experiences, one is doing something and testing it. But the assumption is consciential energy. I'd say without it, we don't have self-experimentation conscientiology.
Right.
The beginning of it is the awareness to consciential energy.
Is that because you're focused, like the examples you just gave were focused on bioenergy exercises, right? Moving energy, vibrational state, those kinds of things, exteriorizing energy. And it strikes me that this is, so everybody can do this. Everybody has this energy and everybody can move this energy, right? So that's, we can, from between us, that's a given fact. But also some people don't feel it, right? Some people feel it a lot more. Some people have much greater sensitivity to it and perceive certain things. So that immediately creates a kind of separation between people that can do these experiments because they have perceptions around those energies and people who perhaps would find it more difficult to do those kinds of experiments. But it strikes me that there could be other kind of experiments that we can do. It's kind of in a similar category, like they're self-experiments, like, for example, changing our diet, right? Everybody can change their diet. We could all spend 2 weeks changing our diet in a certain way. Maybe we cut out meat and eat lots of green vegetables. Cut out sugar and replace it with, I don't know, something else that's, you know, supposedly that's better for us. And then see how we feel and take notes and register the changes in our body and in our mood and in our sanity and our thoughts and our emotions. That would be a kind of self-experiment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That would be, but you know that I was trying to find if anyone was talking about self-experimentation without conscientiology, outside conscientiology or in conventional science, and I actually found that it's been used in medicine, psychology for a long time.
Yes. You
know, as a method, indeed, as a method. And for example, in behavioral psychology, cognitive psychology, they use self-experimentation as a therapy. When for example, someone goes and they call it a challenge, they challenge a belief or something. They go there and do something they believe they can't. So yes. They go there and challenge it. And some psychologists, they treat it as self-experimentation, really, with that, you know, that same phrase. So I would say those are self-experiments, but they are not conscientiological. They are conventional. But, okay, they show what is a self-experiment. That's why I say that the minimum to have a conscientiological self-experimentation is the bioenergetic variable to make it. But of course, they go beyond the simply moving energies. They go beyond that because As you just mentioned, Conscienciology has this important concept of thosin, the thosin. So the thosin is an important variable in self-experimentation. Because, for example, when I make a self-experiment, for example, with my cardio chakra, that's it's only energy, but it's not only energy. The what happens in someone's chakra reflects the thosins.
And just to be clear, thosin is thought, emotion, and energy. So that's the bundle, right? Yeah.
So the thosin is this concept in Conscienciology that unifies thoughts, emotions, and energies, and it's the basic unit of our manifestation. So say, well, we're always having thoughts, emotions, and energies, through energies. So this is energy. If I, the way I perceive my energies, it reflects my thosins. So if I try to change my thosins, I try to like invert the logic, you know, instead of I feel some energies like that. Well, if I try to change my thosins, what will happen with my energies? You know, I can, that's an experiment. That's a self-experiment. Totally, you know, conscienciological, because it's, well, it's dealing with a reality that's not accepted in conventional sciences and so on. So it's more intraconsciential. It's more like internal.
Yes.
But it is a self-experimentation, but it, I can't, at this moment, I can't conceive a self-experiment in Conscienciology that's not some way related to energies. I think it's not a self-experiment, I think. By the way, I think there are other methods that are not different than self-experimentation Conscienciology. It's not the only method. I think there are others.
Okay, do you want to expand on that? These other methods?
Yeah, for example, the when one answers the Conscientiogram. The Conscientiogram, it's a book with 2,000 questions about consciousness and one's consciousness. I think the Conscientiogram, it's based on another method. It's not a self the act of answering the questions, they're not meant to be self-experiments. They are meant to be like self-research from using data from the memory, from memory.
Right. You know? It's like a psychogram, right? It's like a self-evaluation, but instead of just being psychological self-evaluation, it's got that broader coverage of looking at conscious through the consciential paradigm with consciousness at the heart of it, right?
Yeah. But yes, but my point is that the data which come from self-experimentation, it's one kind of data.
Yes.
But the data that comes from answering the Conscientiogram is another kind of data. And they are both, I think, legitimate data on scientific research, on conscienciological research. So the method behind it is different. I call it self-anamnesis, this other method. Right. Anamnesis means in Greek to recall something.
Okay.
And to recall. So we often do that when we recall experiences, past experiences, and evaluate them or assess them in a way. And it's a different logic, a different approach than self-experimentation. It has a different objective. So self-experimentation has, in a way, a practical objective. It's an intervention in one's own manifestation. Yes. I can aim practical results, like recycling myself or trying to change some behavior or something, doing self-experimentation. But doing this kind of thing that I call self-anamnesis, it aims to make to expand my own view about myself, about what I need to improve, what I am already good at, and so on, the traits. And there are other methods, but I think we are only starting to dig, you know, to process the new approaches conscienciology offers.
Yeah.
And I think we shouldn't be, I know we need to be persistent in that, because many times we don't have the tools to do that, how can I say, available. We need to make the tools in order to do this work.
Yeah. One thing that rises for me when listening to you, which I think is an important distinction perhaps from that distinguishes conscienciology from, say, even the psychology or social science self-experimentation, is that view that we are essentially here in this life, that we start seeing this whole life as a kind of experiment and as a kind of point of research, right? That we are trying to approach ourselves as consciousness and study ourselves as we manifest in this life. So I think you talked in one of your talks that I saw, we talk about laboratories, consciential laboratories, and there is kind of the distinction between the external laboratories, a place where you go and do your experimentation, and then our internal laboratory, which is basically us and our manifestations and how we show up.
Yeah, the notion of, I think the notion of self-experimentation is inseparable from this internal laboratory. I think the self-experiment, it happens inside our own laboratories. So it's when one does self-experimentation, at the same time one activates their self, their consciential laboratory. So this notion of making human existence as a big experiment, you know, a long self-experiment, that summarizes what the consciential paradigm means. So what I think this is one way of approaching what is it like to live according to or to internalize the consciential paradigm, you know, to make it a worldview.
Right.
The conscienciological laboratory, the external, you know, I mean the building.
Yes.
And we find it in campus.
Yeah.
Has it and so on. The conscientious laboratory, it's a tool, it's an instrument in order to improve our conscientious laboratories, I think. So we go there and there's this bioenergetic field with very, how can I say, saturated. Some information or the conscienciological laboratory, the building, it is always used for the same thing, like vibrational state.
One purpose, yes.
One purpose, it has a name in it. Vibrational state, retrocognitions, or personal energetic task, penta.
Yes.
So everyone goes there to do to kind of look for the same subject. So it begins, it gets saturated. It makes it easier because the energy is very dense there with that. So even people which have difficulties on feeling energies, perhaps it's easier for them to have the experience there inside one of those places. But the I think the lesson is to, when one develops the consciential laboratory, you know, you carry it everywhere. Like you carry, you make everywhere a conscientiological laboratory. Say, like where you work, like where I work, where my family lives, where I meet with my friends, everywhere become a conscientiological laboratory in a way. Like the, so the place is like a pedagogical tool, like, or a didactical tool to learn about the consciential laboratory, I think. Okay. But at the same time, they can provide new experiences as well. And that's important. I don't want to miss this. I don't mean to, how can I say, consider experience less than experiment. You know, it's not about hierarchy. Experiment is a focus on experience, but experience is the main thing. Like experience is the source to do experiments. And we are challenged by new experiences we don't expect. We are challenged by it. So I think it's not a matter of like an experiment is more than an experience.
Right.
I think it's not. It's not more, but it's a new approach.
Maybe a more technical, it's a technical approach to producing and interpreting and tracking experiences, maybe.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's worth mentioning with the laboratories, the external laboratories, they do immediately invoke and involve an element that is crucial to conscienciology, which is absent from conventional science, which is that we operate on the assumption that we are working with extra-physical consciousnesses, and that in those laboratories, it's not just the bioenergy, the like you said, kind of like the intention that saturates them by people always going and doing the same thing in the same building, in the same space. But we also have the assumption that there are dedicated extra-physical helpers, scientists, if you want, from the other side that are involved, right? That give each laboratory its particular focus, its particular flavor, and support particular experiences in them.
That's another advantage of those places which are saturated, because they make it easier to actually perceive these extra-physical consciousnesses. We have this assumption as a hypothesis, but the ideal is that everyone tries to perceive them. What is it like to be helped by an extra-physical helper? How do I feel the presence of an extra-physical helper, and so on? And in the laboratories, it's more likely to perceive them.
Now I think the last question I want to touch on, I would feel remiss not to ask it, because I see it sometimes online and so on, right? The criticism, one of the criticisms of conscienciology is how reliant a lot of it is on the work of one man, right? Valdiviera and his, not just his intellectual contribution in all his writings, but also his experiences, and it is very common if you listen to Tertullia's conscientiological presentations, the regular events, there's a recurring reference to Valdiviera's experiences as a foundation for our understanding. And I guess you could look at that and say, well, in that sense, how different is it from a religious framework where you're taking the word of very few people perhaps to base your understanding on that. So what are your thoughts about that aspect?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we can't deny that he was the proposer. You know, he proposed him this new approach. So, but he was not the only one. Like, take Sigmund Freud, for example. He was the proposer of psychoanalysis. So that's not a problem. The fact that a new knowledge comes from one person, that's not the problem. I think the problem is to consider his experiences as foundational. I think that's not correct. What's the foundation is the framework he built from his experiences, but from others too. Like, we can't ignore, at the time he published the projectology treatise, he probably had the biggest bibliography of projections or out-of-body experiences. So he read everything and he met all people all around the world. So I think it's oversimplifying, you know, to say, oh, we are, if someone has this kind of relation with Consensuology, like a believer, well, that's a wrong approach. Because what we have is the publications, not the treatises, the experience we should take as hypothesis for us. For example, Valdo had at the end of his life, I think a few years after, you know, and the final years of his life, he said he had a direct experience with a free extraphysical consciousness.
Mm.
Probably he was the only one that had, if he had one. But considering the theoretical framework of consensuology, it's a possible thing. It's possible.
Is this a different experience? Because he actually writes about his projection in his Projections of the Consciousness. He writes about a projection So this was a different kind of experience you're talking about?
Yes, it was. Yeah. That one in the Projections of Consciousness, it was a projection and he met with other people in a mental somatic dimension and so on.
Yes.
That one, he had another kind of experience, and I think it's published in the last books, one of the last books, but I would like to summarize it. The foundation of consensuology is not his experiences. They are not his experiences. They are the framework he built. And, but it's all hypothetical. It's how can I say that? We need to develop the many subdisciplines of consensuology in order to make them more consistent methodologically, and to make it, I'd say, even more professional. You know, he was the first one, he proposed a new approach.
Yes.
But it's up to us to develop it and make it even more consistent and more scientific, let's say that. What is already, I think, it is scientific, but it can be more developed.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And is that part of your role as the coordinator there at what was the title? Inter-Scientific Council at the International Union of Conscio-Centric Institutions. And it might be worth just pointing out for people listening that we're talking about consensuology. There are actually many different organizations now that study and research different elements of consensuology.
Yeah. I think there are 24 exactly at the time.
Right.
And the union, the International Union, it's an institution which tries to coordinate, you know, to propose, how can I say, goals, the same goals in order to, and the Interscientific Council, it's a reunion, it's an assembly of the scientific coordinators of the organizations.
Right.
So we work with, we can say scientific policies, policy.
Policies, yeah.
Yes, scientific policies for the conscienceological organizations. So every July, we have this event. It's called Parascientific Week, where people bring their recent research and they present it. It's like a scientific event. And this year, 2023, we'll have the 10th Parascientific Week.
Okay.
And in 2024, next year, we'll have at this time of the Parascientific Week, we'll have the first International Congress of Conscientiology. So it's now we some people they don't believe it's the first. Like, how come it's only now it's happening the first? But
well, so I'm curious about that actually myself, because I know there's been many conferences events. I know a few years ago there was an event with Charles Tart. I think he came as a guest speaker. I don't know what kind of event that was, but so what's different about this Congress from other events?
Yeah, that one you mentioned with Charles Tart, it was the Congress of Projectology.
Okay.
So there has been many congresses, but always about sub-disciplines or sub-fields of conscientiology and never a general one.
Right.
And I suppose for many, many reasons. And being one of them, we don't have one organization for the entire conscientiology. And they do those events within one organization. So they make the Congress, for example, for that subfield, their subfield. So the International Union of Conscientiocentric Institutions is probably the one who should make this general, you know, Congress, because it's the institution, the organization, which is more related to the whole of conscientiology, let's say. So it seems natural for us, after 10 international, the Parascientific Week,
yes,
now it's time for a Congress, because it's been growing all those years. So, well, let's make the Parascientific Week the International Congress of Conscientiology. Let's make it like wider, you know, let's try to bring more people and so on. Because the Parascientific Week, it's kind of a like specialist event, maybe,
yes,
like more technical, but a Congress, no, it's for everyone. So,
and so what can people expect there? It's I know there's a call for papers, so anybody with an interest in multidimensionality, they don't necessarily have to be conscientiology researchers, I guess.
We're expecting papers which discuss the scientific aspect of conscientiology. The call for papers has some subjects,
right?
And we would like to discuss that, you know, the foundations, like methodological foundations on every subfield, for instance. So we are interested mainly on that, like discussing the Congress. The subtitle of the Congress is Cosmovision of Conscientiologist Scientificity.
Right.
Cosmovision of Conscientiologist Scientificity, because we want to update what's being done from those years. You know, it's the 30th anniversary of the 700 experiments.
Mm.
It was published in 1994. So along those 30 years, what's been done like to develop the science of Consensuology. So we want to make this update. That's the main goal of the Congress. So we'll be discussing how the specialist teams in Consensuology, how do they understand, how they understand their discipline, you know, what they are doing, what their methods, and so on.
Yeah. And that so the event will be in Iguazu Falls at the CIA campus. And will it be in Portuguese, in English? What's the language?
It will be, well, of course, it's in Brazil and there are many, you know, Portuguese speakers. But we will try to make it, we'll try to translate it. We'll have translation. And the people who can present in English, we will ask them to speak in English. And we'll try to bring English the more we can in the event. We're saying that English will be the official language. And we'll see how can we actually do that. But that's our intention, you know, to make it really international. Allow people which though they don't speak Portuguese, they can participate and to understand what's happening.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. And there'll be a link to the event information in the show notes to this podcast. I will post a link.
Thanks.
And the other thing I'll post a link to is your journal, Interparadigmas.
Okay, thank you.
People can download that for free, right? The journal can be downloaded.
Yeah, the website at this moment it is in Portuguese, but every publication there is also in English. So if you navigate there, I think people they can download and will find the English material there.
Yeah. And Alexandre, is there anything else you'd like to share or clarify at the end?
Well, I hope I was clear enough.
Yes.
Unfortunately, my English is not. I tried my best, and I also hope that more people which are interested in this topic of the foundations of the consensuological science, they can show up and they can get in touch. We can discuss if other people want to, you know. And we are open to, Consensuology is open to everyone which is interested. And there are people in Consensuology which are investigating those topics, the scientific foundations of Consensuology.
Yeah.
I think that's the main message.
Yes, and you're one of those people, clearly.
Yeah. Try to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate the conversation and all your insights, Alexandre. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, King. Thank you very much.